Bookstack with Richard Aldous, the Books and Ideas podcast brought to you by AmericanPurpose.com. Coming up on the show today, David Roll, author of the new book, Ascent to Power, How Truman Emerged from Roosevelt's Shadow and Remade the World. David, welcome to Bookstack.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And congratulations on the new book. And as you say, this is the story of death and rebirth.
That's right. The death of Roosevelt, the last few years of Roosevelt's presidency, his selection of Truman to be his vice president, his death, of course, and then the gradual ascent to power and getting out from under Roosevelt's very, very long shadow. And so that's really the theme of the book. It's probably mostly about Truman, but really digs into the last couple of summit conferences that Roosevelt participated in.
And you make a bold claim about this transition from FDR to Truman. It's the most consequential and productive moment in American history since the Civil War, you say.
The only one I think that rivals it or comes close to rivaling it is Teddy Roosevelt. And he had a long string of major achievements. And I sort of compared that in a footnote with Truman and made the assertion that there really was the most consequential transition and sort of amazing because, you know, for 10 years, Truman was a Missouri dirt farmer, no college, could not afford college. But he emerged as a formidable person. Nobody really knew about it, but in World War I, when he directed an artillery unit full of rambunctious Irishmen and tamed them and was decorated, and he was in major combat.
And as you, I mean, you pointed out the education there. I mean, nothing could make that contrast sharper with Roosevelt than education, whereas Truman was educated in public schools, couldn't afford to go to college. Roosevelt, on the other hand, had, you know, everything that you would expect from an elite education. That he went to Groton, he went to Harvard, he went to Columbia. He then found his first job on Wall Street as a lawyer. I mean, the contrast between the two men is really quite striking, isn't it?
Yes, and he had a desk job during World War I, so to speak. He was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, but it was an important position.
Although, they were near contemporaries, so Roosevelt would have been of an age where he could afford.
And in the book, I compare their ascent to power at the beginning, to just kind of give people a sense of the differences between the two of them as they rose. And they didn't really meet one another until Valentine's Day in 1935, when Truman arrived in Washington as a rookie senator from Missouri.
And you show in the book that Roosevelt really had no particular affection or admiration for Truman at all in those early days. In fact, at one stage when Truman is running for re-election at the end of his first term, Roosevelt pretty much puts up a challenger to him in the Democratic primary, and Truman just about sneaks through to hold on, but no thanks to Roosevelt.
Now, Roosevelt dangled an appointment to be in the, I think it was the ICC or something like that, one of the bureaucracies, which would have paid him more, apparently, if he would drop out of the race the second time, because Truman preferred the governor, the former governor of Missouri. So Truman was on his own running the second time with very little money and very little support, except he had a relationship with the notorious Pendergast political machine, which dominated Democratic politics in Missouri.
Yeah, this is one of the ironies, isn't it, about Truman? And you bring it out time and again in the book that, you know, another moment when he's very prominent during the war, when he's running the National Defense Committee, the Truman Committee, and he has a reputation for honesty, for probity. He saves the country huge sums of money. And yet, on the other hand, there is always this background, this murky background of politics and his rise to power in Missouri. So there's a kind of a contradiction between the honesty, but also the realities of the machine politics of the time.
Yeah, I mean, Truman did accept some of the losers that Pendergast shoved off to. He would say, "Will you appoint this guy to help be the county judge?" Well, he was the county judge in Missouri before he became senator, and Pendergast had appointed him to that. And he made his mark in Missouri politics by really saving a lot of money for the Missouri government. But he had to take on some of these losers that Pendergast would say, "You've got to hire this guy." So Truman said, "You know, I did that, but I ended up saving the county and the state a lot of money." And of course, he did that during the war later when he led this committee to investigate the defense industry. And incidentally, almost everyone said that Truman knew nothing about the atomic bomb when he first became vice president. But in fact, as I write in the book, he did know about the bomb before Stimson told him about it when he became president. But while he was vice president at a meeting on August 18th, 1945, when Roosevelt invited him to the White House for a photo op, Roosevelt told him about the atomic bomb, but Truman already knew about it. Through his investigating, his people that investigated the defense industry knew about it, but they kept the secret.
I think, you know, this is one of the interesting elements, this period just before Truman becomes the vice presidential nominee in 1944, that Roosevelt is somewhat dismissive of the Truman Committee. It's clear that he wants to get rid of his sitting vice president, Henry Wallace. But it's not precisely that he chooses Truman. It's more that he wants a new vice president and the party chooses Truman. Why do they pick Truman as their man when it seems already clear that Roosevelt is a sick man?
It was the big city bosses, New Jersey, New York, and so on. There were bosses at that time that sort of dominated Democratic politics. And they felt that Wallace was a no-no. They were afraid that Roosevelt would try to appoint Wallace again. And Roosevelt promised Wallace that he would appoint him. He promised Jimmy Burns, who was really qualified, that he would have the vice presidency. But in the end, he gave in to the big city bosses. And the bosses wanted Truman because they thought he would be the least harmful to the ticket. You know, he had a pretty good reputation, although the Republicans called him the senator from Pendergast. It was well known in Republican politics where Truman came from. But nevertheless, they thought Jimmy Burns was a segregationist. Labor didn't like him. Wallace was kind of a nut. So anyway, it was the big city bosses that really got Truman. And also Truman was very good friends with a guy named Hannigan from St. Louis, who became head of the Democratic Party. So that's when Hannigan was backing him, because Hannigan helped him in the senatorial elections. And Truman helped him become head of the Democratic Party. So that's how it happened.
One of the things that is very striking in the book is that you make it clear that Roosevelt by this stage knew that Truman would be president. Because as you show in the book, Roosevelt, virtually at the moment that he declares that he's running again, he has a memo from his doctor making it clear that he will not be able to survive for 4 years in office. So Roosevelt knows what's happened quite clearly. The question then, as you ask in the book, is why does he not make more effort to integrate Truman into the team?
Well, I think he was in denial. You know, I think he was told not only a memo, but he was told by his own doctors that he would not survive a fourth term. And, you know, he was in denial a lot of the time about it and thought he could probably beat the odds. And why didn't Truman make an effort? And I look at that, and he had 82 days as vice president before Roosevelt died. So he had all that time, you know, a couple months, more than a couple months. He could have pestered the State Department to give him some updates on what happened at Yalta, what happened at Tehran. He could have hired his own foreign policy expert, as many of our candidates today do when they're vice president. So he didn't do that. You know, he played the piano with Lauren Bacall and things like that. He had a lot of fun during that 82 days because he was celebrated in Washington. And while Roosevelt was off in the Pacific, you know, dealing with MacArthur and all these other things, and Roosevelt, you know, he didn't think Truman was even worth his time. And he was away most of that time. He was away and getting sicker and sicker.
I mean, you call FDR's lack of consultation with Truman a dereliction of duty. But it did bring advantages, as you show in the book, because it meant when Truman did become president, he was very much his own man. He surrounded himself with great figures like Marshall and Dean Acheson and George Kennan and the like. So he genuinely was able to map out his own policy, both at home and abroad.
During his first several months, and actually until the midterms in 1946, you know, he had a lot of the Roosevelt people still with him. You know, he did pick apart the cabinet, got rid of Francis Perkins and, you know, all these others, except for Wallace and Morgenthau. He kept on Morgenthau. But the transformation, really, when he got into his own, was after the midterms, when the Republicans took over both houses of Congress. It was a bloodbath for the Democrats, and Truman's approval ratings were way down. So he came into his own after the midterms. You know, after he voted in independence on that day, he knew he would lose big time. You know, and of course, he wasn't running. It was a midterm. But he came back, got off into Union Station alone, and there was nobody in the station waiting to greet him except for Dean Acheson. And that relationship lasted for the rest of his life. He never got over the fact that there was just one guy there. And at the time, Dean Acheson was Assistant Secretary of State. He went back to Covington in July of 1945, and then came back as Secretary of State after Marshall retired.
It's extraordinary, this period, when you just simply list out what was achieved. There's the Marshall Plan, the Truman Doctrine, the dropping of those first two atomic bombs, the Berlin airlift, the creation of NATO, creation of the Department of Defense and the CIA, recognition of Israel, the Japanese miracle. At home, there's a fairly progressive attempt at civil rights reform. I mean, it's astonishing what is achieved in this period, isn't it, David?
It is. Another thing that's astonishing is that usually the conquerors, you know, they do not treat the nations that they conquered very well. That's the history, long, long history. But it was astonishing that what we did, what Truman did with his administration, is revive Germany as the engine of Europe, and Japan as the engine in East Asia. And also their strategic ally in Asia was Japan. They revived it. Eventually, they had the Japanese miracle. And so it is astonishing where America stood after World War II as a result of Truman. The Truman Doctrine, you know, which was to help, as he put it, help free peoples, help democracy. That was his speech in March of 1947. His speech proclaimed, he said, I believe it should be the policy of the United States to assist free peoples, democracies, wherever they are, that are being threatened by autocratic regimes and ideologies. That doctrine existed for several decades, and in fact, exists today with Ukraine and so forth. And it is being challenged today as it has never been before.
I mean, of course, his critics say that this ramps up the military aspect of American foreign policy. Eisenhower would later talk about the creation of the military industrial complex. Where do you stand on that kind of criticism?
Well, you know, Truman was a pro-military guy. I mean, Marshall was his real guy that persuaded him to put money into the military. But actually, Marshall wanted to have universal military service, and Truman bought into that. And they were defeated because it would appear if we did that. Marshall said, look, we're never prepared when we go to war. We need to have a standing militia, essentially, that are trained so they can go into battle more quickly. And they tried to get Congress to pass that several times, and they failed. And because that was warmongering, you know, and that whole thing just, you know, collapsed. So he was basically a military guy, but they got stymied by that.
I mean, one of the things that is always fascinating about Truman is that his very modest personal demeanor often meant that he was underestimated and underrated, particularly at the time. It was a surprise to many when he won again in 1948. But there is a kind of a sense in which, as historians have moved through generations, he has come to be recognized as a president equal in greatness to somebody like, or at least approaching equal in greatness to presidents like Roosevelt.
One of the greats, they used to say one of the greats, you know, behind Roosevelt, Lincoln, Washington, the big three, and then there are Teddy Roosevelt. He ranked right up there, and it was surprised everybody.
But it does raise an interesting question in terms of today's politics, whether you think that somebody like Truman, with this very, as I say, very modest demeanor, would actually be able to translate that into the kind of more showbiz kind of politics that we see today.
Well, I say in my book, and I believe it, that during the 48 election, Truman was no wallflower. His campaign in the fall of 1948 was a rollicking roadshow, and he did have a showman character to him. I read all of his speeches during that campaign. I saw some of the things that he did in Iowa and Ohio, which were key states that helped win the election. And honest to God, he bordered on demagoguery. He lied. He would call the GOP the gluttons of privilege, the Wall Street gluttons of privilege, and they put a pitchfork at the back of the farmers. He claimed that the GOP was trying to take away price supports for farmers. Well, they weren't, but he made a big deal of that as he went through the Midwest, and the Midwest was critical to winning because he lost the South. He had to make up for losing the South because of his civil rights stand. And his civil rights stand meant that you had a third party. He actually had another party. Wallace was also running against him. So he had rallies that were not that far from the kind of Trump rallies you see today.
And I mean, it's interesting you use that phrase that he wasn't a wallflower. One of the things that comes across time and time again in the book is his steeliness. One of my favorite stories comes towards the end when he's traveling to Eisenhower's inauguration. He's in the car with Eisenhower, and Eisenhower apologizes for not coming to Truman's 1949 inauguration because he didn't want to attract attention. And then Truman gives this icy reply where he says, "You didn't come because I didn't send for you. But if I had sent for you, you would have come." Everyone else in the car gasps when he says this. But it seemed to me to be absolutely characteristic of the man.
He had amazing confidence in saying something like that. You know, here he revered Eisenhower during the war. In fact, actually at the Potsdam Conference, in 1945, when they were in Germany, they had a day off, and Truman went over to see Eisenhower at his headquarters in Frankfurt or something. And he said, "You know, is there anything you want? I'll do anything you want. You know, if you want to be president, you can be president in my place." I mean, how about that? And Eisenhower couldn't believe it. You know, said, you know, I'm not interested in that right now. And nobody knew whether he was a Democrat or a Republican in any event. Another sort of shocking thing was that during the 48 campaign, the Roosevelt family was basically running a dump Truman movement. They wanted him to step back, and they wanted Eisenhower. And this included two of Roosevelt's sons were very actively campaigning to get Eisenhower on the Democratic ticket. And Eleanor Roosevelt actually also, she didn't say anything at first. All she could say to Truman was, well, the boys are, you know, I can't help it, what they do. But she had written letters saying that she wanted Truman out as well. That's what he was facing in the 48 election.
I mean, so one of the other things that is very striking, and one of the comparisons that is often made, for example, we've had Mary Cerotti on the show talking about her book, Not One Inch, that looks at the post-Cold War era, is the striking difference between those two periods that, you know, in the period after the kind of the Cold War, we are now living through many of the consequences of decisions that were made in that time. This generation after the Second World War, with those names that we've talked about, Truman, Kennan, Paul Nitzer, Marshall, Dean Acheson, these kind of characters, Avril Harriman would be another.
And Arthur Vandenberg.
And Arthur Vandenberg, yeah. Which, you know, again, that sense of, you know, policy stopping on the water's edge and it being across political boundaries and so on. I mean, they really were a genuinely remarkable generation in what they achieved. I don't think there's any doubt about that, is there?
And he was so lucky to have them. Another person that we didn't mention was Clark Clifford. And he had such an influence. Truman called him the counselor to the president. Recognition of Israel and civil rights. Civil rights and the recognition of Israel were Clifford's persuasion. Truman was somewhat ambivalent about the recognition decision, and he was also ambivalent about civil rights, but it was Clifford who really made that happen.
And yeah, finally, David, I mean, we haven't had the easiest times with transitions from one president to another recently, to say the least. What lessons can we learn from this transition? And also the efforts that Truman made with his transition to Eisenhower. What can we draw on for our own politics today?
Well, I mean, Truman, I think, was the first to sort of initiate a formal transition policy. He had a whole agenda that he tried to, at the time of the transition, Eisenhower distrusted Truman. In fact, wouldn't even get out of the automobile when they went to the inauguration. He waited for Truman to come out the White House doors, and then they rode up. But he did succeed in getting a transition policy established within the bureaucracy. And that was the first time that really happened. Lessons learned. You got to, he was done being president. He could have run that time, but he said, no, I'm not going to run. And he felt that because of his experience with Roosevelt, who told him nothing, that he felt that presidents needed to know the whole score before they are sworn into office. So lessons learned, Truman started that process.
So the book is Ascent to Power, How Truman Emerged from Roosevelt's Shadow and Remade the World. It's written by my guest, David Roll. And published by Dutton. But for now, David, congratulations again. It's such an enjoyable book. Thanks for joining us on Bookstack.
Thank you so much.
So that's it from us this week. Don't forget to check our website, AmericanPurpose.com, and to leave us a review on your podcast app. The show is produced by Laura Silverman, and this is me, Richard Alder, saying thanks for listening.